Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is October 23rd, 2015, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Just Beat It, Atrial Fibrillation with Diltiazem or Metoprolol. And back again as one of our favorite guest skeptics is Dr. Anand Swaminathan, or Swami as he's better known. Swami is an assistant program director at NYU Bellevue Hospital in beautiful New York City, and he's also part of the Rebel Alliance with Salim Razai. He also works with the teaching course with Rob Rogers, recently emergency medical abstracts, and this new foamy good website called Core EM. Welcome back to the SGEM, Swami.
Hey, Ken, it's good to be here. You know, we get to do a lot of stuff together, but it's actually been a while since I've been on the SGEM, so nice to be back on.
It has been too long. But you know what? You've got a lot going on. You've got a new baby, and you've joined the longest EM education program in the world, Emergency Medical Abstracts, which used to be called the Rick and Jerry Show.
Yeah, it's been a great experience working on EMA, just sort of honing my skills and having you and Chris and all these people to sort of help me with my ability to read the articles and understand them and then communicate that to everybody too.
And I'm looking forward to hanging out with you in New York City.
Yeah, we're going to have a great time. Teaching course, November. It's going to be absolutely phenomenal. Amazing faculty. I think we have 70 attendees, which is amazing because last year I think we had 20. So this is going to be a huge course. It's going to be great. I think we're going to have a ton of fun, Ken.
I am really looking forward to it. But let's start this program off with a case.
All right, so here's the case that we're going to talk about. A 53-year-old woman with no past medical history presents to the ED with palpitations for 4 days. She says she feels a bit fatigued and a bit short of breath. Her vitals show a pressure of 153 over 72, a heart rate of 137 beats per minute, and on physical exam, you notice that her heart rate is irregular, and she gets a 12 lead that confirms she's got AFib with RVR.
And that's rapid ventricular response. And atrial fibrillation is one of the most common dysrhythmias we see in the emergency department. Atrial flutter is less common, but it's managed pretty much the same way.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of debate on the management of patients with recent onset atrial fibrillation, which is typically less than 48 hours, as to whether we should cardiovert those patients or whether we should leave them in atrial fibrillation.
And we actually did a podcast looking at the aggressive, yes, the aggressive, these are Canadians, the Ottawa aggressive atrial fibrillation protocol. Hard to believe, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that was back in episode 88 of the SGEM. And this aggressive protocol is a very effective for new onset atrial fibrillation, but it wouldn't apply in this case because this patient had symptoms for 4 days.
Yeah, so we don't have to delve into that part of the conversation. Now, in patients with chronic atrial fibrillation or an unknown time of onset, that rapid ventricular rate does need to be controlled. We have to consider sort of what medications to use to control it. And then we also are going to have to start those patients on anticoagulation therapy based on what their risk is for developing a clot.
Yeah, and both beta blockers and calcium channel blockers are commonly used for rate control in the emergency department. But it is unclear whether one of these agents is superior to the other. And there's really scant, and I mean scant, high quality data on the topic.
Yeah, so that brings us to our clinical question, Ken. In patients with atrial fibrillation and a rapid ventricular response, what agent, beta blocker or calcium channel blocker, will obtain rate control the fastest?
And what's the reference that we have for this?
So this is from Fromm et al., Diltiazem versus Metoprolol in the management of atrial fibrillation or flutter with rapid ventricular rate in the emergency department. This was in the Journal of Emergency Medicine in 2015.
And I want to mention that this paper was picked via the hot or not function. And every week we post 5 recent publications and ask SGEMers to rate it as hot or not. These papers picked as hot get a skeptical eye placed upon the manuscript. So if you have not signed up for this hot new function on the SGEM, have your voice heard and help us pick the article. But let's go through the PICO. What was the population in this Fromm study?
So this was adult patients greater than or equal to 18 years of age presenting with atrial fibrillation or atrial flutter.
And as always, there was a number of exclusion criteria, and so I'll list them on the blog. What was the intervention?
So the intervention was either diltiazem 0.25 milligrams per kilogram to a max dose of 30 milligrams or metoprolol 0.15 mg per kg to a max dose of 10 IV.
And they didn't have a control. They were just comparing the diltiazem versus metoprolol. But what was their primary outcome, Swami?
So the primary outcome was a true emergency department physician outcome. Heart rate less than 100 beats per minute within 30 minutes of drug administration. And I say a true emergency physician metric because that's exactly what we want. We want to get that rate controlled as quickly as possible and get the patient off to their destination.
And they had a safety outcome too, didn't they?
They did. So heart rate less than 60 or SBP, systolic blood pressure, less than 90 millimeters of mercury.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, diltiazem was more effective in achieving rate control in the emergency department patients with atrial fibrillation or flutter and did so with no increased incidence of adverse effects, end of quote. Well, it was a randomized control trial, so let's go through the 11 quality checklists. The first one is, were these emergency patients?
Absolutely. So all the recruitment was done in the ED.
And did they randomize them adequately?
They did. So they used a one-to-one computerized randomization. It was done very well.
Did they conceal the randomization?
They did.
And were the patients analyzed in the groups which they were randomized? In other words, an intention to treat analysis?
Yeah, exactly. So they did an intention to treat here. So if they were randomized to beta blocker, that's what they were analyzed in.
And how about selection bias? Were the study patients recruited consecutively?
So here's the first one that we fall a little bit short on. They were not. This was a convenience sample, and the authors do not tell us how many patients with AFib and RVR presented that they didn't include in the study. So we don't really know what the total number was that came in.
And the patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yeah, they were. They didn't note any differences in baseline characteristics here.
And how about blinding?
Yeah, the blinding was pretty well done as well.
And were they all treated equally except for the intervention?
They were.
And how was the follow-up? Was it more than 80%?
Well, you know, you would expect that the follow-up would be really good when the primary outcome was 30 minutes. Even we can focus for 30 minutes. And their follow-up was 100%.
Sorry, what were you saying? You lost me there. No, all patient important outcomes, were they considered?
Well, you know, this one's a little tricky. I would say not really. You know, the primary outcome here was rate control within 30 minutes, but there were no longer-term outcomes that were looked at.
And was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
It was.
All right, so let's go through the results. They had 52 patients enrolled in the study, 28 in the metoprolol group and 24 in the diltiazem group. The mean age of the patients was 66 years and 53% were women.
Yeah, so the mean systolic blood pressure was 132. The mean diastolic blood pressure was 89. About two-thirds of the patients were new onset atrial fibrillation, but again, they were outside of that window for cardioversion.
Well, let's not bury the lead here, Swami. What was the primary outcome of heart rate less than 100 beats per minute at 30 minutes?
So this was achieved in 96% of patients who got diltiazem versus only 46% of patients who got metoprolol. And that gives us an NNT of...
Two. Pretty impressive, yeah.
Yeah, really amazing.
And you know what they did? They did every 5 minutes. Every 5 minutes they took a reading, and the diltiazem group was more likely to be rate controlled to a heart rate less than 100 beats per minute than the metoprolol group. And they didn't observe any differences in the group in terms of hypotension or bradycardia. But it's time to talk a little nerdy.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Ken, both you and I have talked about this multiple times, and in our informal poll of emergency physicians, diltiazem or calcium channel blockers seem to be the preferred agent for rate control in these patients with atrial fibrillation and RVR. Now, on the other hand, every time I use diltiazem, the cardiologist tells me, you know, we would have preferred to use a beta blocker instead. They have better outcomes, you know, blah, 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 blah. This study appears to support the preference of EPs, and I would love it if we could just stop there and say, you know what, our biases were confirmed by this literature. We can go ahead and push forward with the calcium channel blockers. The cardiologists don't know what they're talking about, but there were some issues that I think we need to touch on.
How many issues were there, Swami?
Well, I'm going to go ahead and guess that there were five issues.
Yeah. So the first one we wanted to bring up, and you mentioned a bit earlier, was this convenient sample. These were not consecutive patients presenting to the emergency department, but rather a convenient sample. And this can introduce selection bias into the study. We're not given information on how many patients presented in atrial fibrillation with rapid ventricular response that would allow us to know how many patients were not approached for this study at all. And this adds to the possibility that some patients were felt, yeah, you're not good enough to get in this study, and thus were not considered. Or there were patient characteristics that caused physicians to not even approach them.
Yeah, I think this is a big point that we have to stress. Number two was that the trial was stopped early. The authors performed a sample size calculation, and they determined that they would need 200 patients in the study to get an 80% power to detect non-inferiority. However, they only ended up with 54 patients recruited and 52 included for their analysis.
And they do explain why they stopped early. They explain that a blinded, independent biostatistician recommended stopping the study because more patients in the diltiazem group were achieving that desired endpoint.
Yeah, the researchers observed a large effect size during the interim analysis, but the problem is that probably overinflates the effect size. It would probably have regressed to the mean if the study had continued.
Exactly. And also, you mentioned that this was a non-inferiority trial, and there are differences between a superiority, non-inferiority, and equivalence trials. And I've asked my friend, superhero Anthony Crocco at Sketchy EBM, to do a video to explain these concepts in more detail. But until then, if you want to know more about non-inferiority studies and the problems with stopping trials early, I'm going to put up some links in the show notes that include a paper by Mueller et al. On how to use non-inferiority trials. Montori did a study on randomized trials stopped early for benefits, a systematic review. And finally, Mueller et al. Wow, they're all M names. Ethical issues in stopping randomized trials early because of apparent benefit.
Yes, you know, Anthony's site is absolutely amazing. I went and checked it out and I learned a ton. The way that he explains things is so simple and it's perfect for us that are trying to still learn our evidence-based medicine. And you sent these three articles to me and I kind of plowed through them before we recorded. And again, some great stuff, very simply written, very simply explained of why it's not so great to stop early when you have a treatment benefit, when you see a big benefit, because most likely it is going to come back to the mean.
And that Sketchy EBM site, I love his tagline, draw your own conclusions.
Oh, it's great. Absolutely. And a bit of a pun there, right, Ken?
A bit of a pun.
All right. So our third issue, getting back to the topic at hand, was drug dosing. This has been a big critique. And I learned a lot about this on the foam world too, because I don't use a lot of metoprolol in my department. So the diltiazem was dosed at 0.25 mg per kg for a max dose of 30. The metoprolol was given at 0.15 mg per kg with a max dose of 10 milligrams. And this may not be an equivalent comparison. So again, talking to some people that I work with, talking to some of the cardiologists, they said, you know, we probably would have gone with a higher dose of metoprolol. So it's a bit shy on that dosing. However, again, the study authors did allow for additional doses to be given if rate control was not achieved at 15 minutes. The question was, is that additional 15 minutes from there out, is that enough time for the additional dose to help and give you that rate control?
And the fourth point we wanted to bring up was the patient-oriented outcome. We question whether achieving a heart rate of less than 100 beats per minute in 30 minutes is a really patient-centered outcome. It's definitely not a hard patient-centered outcome like, I don't know, death. But you're not going to see much in a study like this when it comes to rate control. It would have been nice to have an additional longer-term outcome aside from simply 30 minutes after drug administration. I mean, did the patient stay rate controlled? Did either of the groups, once rate controlled, require additional medication to stay rate controlled? And if so, how much? I think these and other important questions need to be asked.
Yeah, like I mentioned before, I think instead of a patient-centered outcome here, we have a physician-centered outcome. Once I get that person under 100, I can then bring them up to the floor and they're no longer clogging up my emergency department. Now, I'm sure the patient would also like to be out of the emergency room, but I think this is a little bit more physician-centered here. Our fifth issue here was external validity. This was a single-center study. This isn't an issue for me because the study was done right up the street from me in the Bronx. They've got an inner city population that's very similar to mine, but Ken, it may not be as applicable to you.
Yeah, we always need to consider external validity. And working in a community hospital or a more rural center, I'm wondering, are these the same patients? And we don't know. And that's why it's always great to have multi-center studies so you get a broader patient population. But Swami, despite these limitations, this represents the best evidence on this particular topic. And there is limited research looking at the optimal agent for rate control. Brian Hayes did an excellent review of the literature on this topic for Academic Life in Emergency Medicine a while back and recently updated it with a post including this study. And we'll have a link in the show notes.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of your points here are really well taken. You know, I knew that this study applied to my population because one of the patients ripped out his IV and walked out after consenting to the trial. And that is exactly what I see on a regular basis.
Well, how about you comment on the author's conclusions compared to the SGEM's conclusions?
Yeah, absolutely. So I agree with the author's conclusions here. Despite the above limitations, they did demonstrate non-inferiority of diltiazem to metoprolol for rapid rate control of patients with AFib with RVR, and this goes along with my clinical experience.
So the bottom line is the best available evidence shows that diltiazem will achieve a more rapid rate control in patients with atrial fibrillation than metoprolol.
Yeah, so let's wrap up the case here too, Ken. So the patient was given 0.25 mg per kg of diltiazem as a slow push, and 10 minutes after the push, her rate came down to 93 beats per minute. She was started on oral diltiazem to continue rate control. The emergency physician performed a CHADS-VASc score on the patient, and she was found to be very low risk for stroke. Therefore, she was started on aspirin alone, discharged home with follow-up with a cardiologist in 2 days.
I'm going to take this and apply it clinically, knowing that this evidence is suboptimal, and this study has some flaws. This set of data, though, defends the emergency physician's use of diltiazem for rate control in atrial fibrillation with rapid ventricular response. But what are you going to tell your patient at the bedside, Swami?
Yeah, this is a really key thing because we got to educate the patient, especially if we're going to send them home and we're not going to admit them to the hospital. We have to make sure they understand their disease and what's going to be expected to happen. So this is how I would phrase it. It appears that the cause of your symptoms is that your heart is in an irregular rhythm called atrial fibrillation. Your heart rate's really high, so we're going to give you a medicine to reduce it. This is also going to make you feel more comfortable. We have two major medication choices, but the best available evidence indicates that a medication called diltiazem is going to get you to rate control fastest. Once we've got you rate controlled, we're going to look and see whether you're at a high risk for stroke, start you on something as an anticoagulant or an antiplatelet agent, and we're going to arrange follow-up with a specialist.
Very nice. Well, that sound means that it's time for the Keener contest, and last week's winner was Thomas Freeman. He is the chief resident from Georgia Regents University in Augusta, Georgia. He knew that the smallest bone in the human body is the stapes. What's our Keener question this week, Swami?
All right, so something really relevant to our topic here. Name the Dutch doctor who invented the first practical ECG machine over 100 years ago.
If you know the answer, then be the first person to email the sgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line to win that cool skeptical prize. Well, thank you, Swami, for being such an amazing guest skeptic.
Oh, it was absolutely my pleasure to highlight this wonderful article that's so relevant to our practice.
Hey, and you know what? This has got me thinking. We need to do another SGEM classic paper again.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we did some great articles before, but you know, we got to find something new and maybe we can bring on an extra person to help us out.
Yeah, how about the man, the myth, the legend, Dr. Jerry Hoffman, to discuss the classic Nexus C-spine paper?
Yeah, he has some very, very distinct thoughts on that particular study. I think it would be great to hear him come on. You know, Ken, if we really want to go the extra mile, we could maybe try and bring Ian Steele on to talk about it on another episode. But, you know, getting Jerry to talk about Nexus, that would be amazing.
All right. It's on my to-do list. But you know what? Just a few announcements about conferences. You mentioned that teaching course, November 10th to 13th, run by Rob Rogers.
And Smack Dub registration is going to open next week as well. I actually just signed up because I get to be a speaker, so I just did my registration. But on Wednesday morning, registration is going to open for everyone. Because of the time differences, you know what I suggest is just go over to the Smack website, figure out with the countdown exactly when it's going to open in your region. There's only going to be a limited number of tickets, so go ahead and sign up for that one too.
Yeah, that's Social Media and Critical Care Conference, and it is fantastic. But until next week, can you give us the SGEM tagline, Swami?
I'd be honored to, Ken. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.